Dr. Cornel West is our guest on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell wanted to take us to all of those things that the United States, well, it sounded like you were going to the other as we broke away, that there are all of these things that are the golden calf.
Well, the golden calf comes out of that justice tradition.
Yes.
And what it does ultimately is fly in the face of justice. Now, it offends the others that you talk about, but it flies in the face of justice.
Absolutely.
The golden, absolutely. In 20 seconds or fewer, not everybody went to Sunday school. Do the golden calf for us.
Well, the very fact that Moses goes up to receive a revelation having to do with justice and righteousness, and the people become restless and they begin to worship a golden calf, resting their own fears and desires in something that is both fleeting and unable to deliver, something that is very attractive, glamorous, and sparkling, but something in the end that, like cotton candy, has no substance or content, has no there. It has no delivering power.
That sounds like pop culture.
Yeah, it's a lot of pop culture. Well, of course, we don't want to engage in monolithic characterizations because every slice of culture has a possibility of an idolatrous and a prophetic side to it.
And it's really important to me to talk about the fact that you have gone from that into hip-hop.
Oh, well, at least trying to relate to a hip-hop generation, because I have too much respect for hip-hop and rap music to say that's what I'm doing. I'm very old school. I'm Motown, Philly Sound, Curtis Mayfield generation kind of brother. But I do speak in the pocket of the music, and I bring in a lot of young musicians to present what Nietzsche called a danceable education. That is to say, to speak in the idiom of young people, because young people have always historically played a disproportionate role in reviving and awakening citizens. We just saw New York City, 1,800 fellow citizens are arrested. It's the biggest, largest mass arrest in the history of New York City. I mean, this is serious business.
This is at the Republican Convention.
At the Republican Convention, disproportionately young people. And we saw it in the 60s, too, with young folk beginning to be suspicious of their parents' views about race and so forth.
There is a quote.
And of being lied to.
That's true. The mendacity.
There's a quote at the beginning of the history of rock and roll that is Plato, when the mode of the music changes, the walls of the city shake. And then it's followed by
Jerry Lee Lewis.
Whole lot of shaking going on.
We were on the
Hugh Masekela show back in the spring. And it's not just...
Now, you're awfully cute, Bill, but he really was on our program.
Okay. Well,
and Hugh Masekela said...
But it's not just the energy of youth, which is very important, and the freshness of youth, and in some ways the naivety, mm-hmm. that anything is possible, and
that's
that,
right.
You know, you shouldn't lie to me. It's also, there is something, and this goes to the jazz and the blues, there's something powerful, there's a powerful voice... In music, in his case, he and lots of other people, the people of South Africa helped liberate South Africa and may end up liberating all of us. But through it, a big piece of it was the music, and that seems
by
to
his
be
telling.
Very, very important.
Absolutely.
In this.
And in fact, when I talk about this third pillar, in addition to the Socratic questioning and prophetic witness, a tragicomic hope rooted in blues jazz, that's inseparable from that music that's connected to what Hugh Masekela and the others in the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. And in fact, I would go as far as to talk about just music itself as a profound expression of the human spirit. In which, if you take, for example, Capriccio, the last great opera, one could argue, 1942, of Richard Strauss, and debate between whether the poetic or the musical, or whether words are sound, instrumental sound is superior. It's kind of echoes of 607b, a book 10 of Plato's Republic about the traditional choral poetry and philosophy. And that last moment in Strauss's opera, you all remember, in the D major, the mirror scene, where she says, this is a sterile debate because it's the human voice. It's my voice, which is the greatest beyond instrumental music on the one hand and poetry on the other. And then she hits a note that could actually probably break some of the glass there. I just saw the opera in Paris just a few months ago, and it just made me shudder almost, like Faust in the Realm of the Mothers. I mean, I was just shaking and shuddering. And here's Strauss at the end of his career, dealing with Nietzsche and Schopenhauerian notions of instrumental music and so forth. And what are we talking about? The human voice. Now, of course, black music begins with the voice. The only thing black folk had control over, their voice and their bodies. They said no control over their labor, no rights, and so forth. So you create a whole tradition that's with the voice, and begins in the minor key, which is very important. It's dissident, that Duke Ellington says. You make dissonance a whole way of life with your voice and body, and if you're lucky, it spills over into political, economic possibility. Possibility. Yes, go right ahead.
You can't have a democracy without that either, can you?
That's my claim. That's my claim. You can't have it without the Socratic. You can't have it without the prophetic. You can't have it without the tragic comic hope of the blues in some form. I mean, black people have no monopoly on this. You got Tennessee Williams, who's a white literary blues man. He's got more blues in him than a lot of black folk we know. It's a choice that people make to wrestle with tragic comic hope, you see.
And to voice it. One can't do that silently and have the same effect, can one?
That's exactly right.
I just luxuriated in this wonderful book, Democracy Matters. And one of the things that you did, not only Emerson, who is virtually forgotten by most people, you also bring me James Baldwin, who you say is a descendant, a direct, he's the child of Emerson, as he struggles in the 50s and 60s and 70s to give birth and hope to a next generation. And you quote from him a book that, if you just stop me in my tracks, when I was maybe 19, I read The Fire Next Time. Mm-hmm. And for weeks, I just walked around. People couldn't reach me. Hello, are you in there? Mm-hmm. I was in his domain. And the importance of him saying you must come to terms with your past and with the hard truths, and you must speak them.
Absolutely.
Or you are forever held back by them.
Absolutely.
Isn't that part of what America must do?
Over and over again.
But what does that mean? What's the story around that?
I think part of it has to do with when Baldwin says that it's the innocence itself that constitutes the crime, even prior to criminal behavior in the form of violence and disrespect. Because the innocence becomes the rationalization for the violence.
Put that in the present.
That when you view yourself as the exemplar of an axis of good, then you appeal to purity and innocence as a way of rationalizing your violence as you subsume others under an axis of evil. Now, yes, there's moral judgments that must be made. Yes, there's certain wisdom that must be exercised. But those appeals to innocence and purity, which are so paradigmatic of the dominant discourses America tells about itself. And within those narratives, there's no Socratic energy. There's no self-criticism. It's self-righteous. There's no prophetic witness. It's very inward oriented. And there's no tragic comic hope. There's Disney World-like optimism. Those are qualitatively different things.
And there's a heresy in it, the Manichaean heresy, that the world is black and white.
That's true.
And that's troublesome.
That makes it simplistic, that makes it childish, that makes it melodramatic rather than tragic.
And you're talking about America right now.
Well, it's been the dominant narrative for a while, but the very fact that now we are the superpower, now what we do disproportionately affects the world in ways that was not the case 50 years ago, means that every life on the planet is affected by what we're talking about.
There's another dialectic that you point to that I simply not come across as clearly articulated, and that is the distinction between Constantine and the Constantinian perspective and the prophetic.
This is huge. Will you talk about that, please?
And you know, not to do a history lesson, but if we forget where we came from, we may not know where we are.
Absolutely.
The Constantinian, that is Constantine, the emperor.
Absolutely.
And the prophetic.
Keep in mind, it was the Roman Empire that put Jesus to death. He was a particular Jew out of prophetic Judaism who, in the eyes of imperial elites, thought he constituted a threat. And like so many other Jews, he was killed. He was murdered. He died the death of a political prisoner. 400 years later, that same Roman Empire would generate an emperor named Constantine who would convert to Christianity. This is 312 AD. 313 is the Edict of Milan, which decriminalizes Christianity. And then his successor, Theodosius I, will incorporate Christianity in making it the official religion of the empire, persecuting all other religions, as Christianity itself had been persecuted between the death of Jesus and 312. Now, most Christians in America, unfortunately, tend to be Constantinian Christians because they now defer to the American Empire. They can't see the night side of the American Empire, which means they really couldn't see the cross, which means the cross in most churches becomes a way of hiding and concealing the meaning of the death and sense of love and suffering of that Jesus on the cross, and becomes simply a stepping stone to upward mobility. So you end up gospels of prosperity, prayers of let's make a deal, spend the wheel of fortune, the pastors as CEOs. It's a market spirituality. It's a very much a business-oriented religiosity that has very little to do with learning how to love and care and live a dangerous life in the face of this unbelievable grace that's coming at you as a gift that will sustain you no matter what.
I think of this as the challenge, the natural antipathy between temporal and spiritual powers. The colleague of yours, Stephen Clark,
Stephen Carter.
Carter.
Oh, yes,
thank you.
Yes, at Yale, indeed.
At Yale, who's a very conservative man.
And very sharp brother.
And deeply religious.
Deeply religious. Mm-hmm.
But he goes on at some length, as you know, about the dangers of confusing and conflating those two forces.
Lest we be confused or conflated, let's pick this up when we come back. Dr. Cornel West is our guest. That, of course, was Bill Russell. I'm Paula Gordon, all three of us. Hope that you'll be with us when we return.